Welcome to the Screamcast episode 139. I am Sean DeRager, and with me is BJ Colangelo.
Oh, hello.
I got really close on the mic for that one.
Yeah. And also, Brad's here. Oh, my God.
I got really close on the mic on mine, too.
Not flattering at all.
I took notes from BJ.
That's how we do professional podcasts. Like, that's how you develop chemistry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Character building.
BJ, you and Zach just wrapped principal photography on Powerbomb.
We sure did. Thank you.
I know that's right.
Very, very, very excited that we've wrapped, because now I can sleep again. But it's been really awesome, and like all of the Indiegogo perks are starting to come through, and the place where I got my enamel pins from threw in some extras, so I'm actually going to have some that I'm able to sell, which I'm pretty pumped about. But yeah, it was an amazing experience, and I'm still kind of reeling from all of it.
Yeah, very cool. Yeah, I may have got a little misty when I read you and Zach's Facebook posts. It's cool. Very cool.
Yeah, we were being real lame about it, being real mushy.
Fine, man. It's all good. So, all right. Well, today we are going to be discussing a couple of Dario Argento films, Phenomena and The Bird with the Crystal Plumage. We're going to be getting some help from a couple of guests. Brad, who are the guests that are going to be joining us?
Two people. Two lovely ladies. I got to remember Stephanie's handle, though. I don't call people by their Twitter handles. That's my problem. So first off, we have Stephanie Crawford, who goes by Scrawfish on Twitter, S-C-R-A-W, Fish. And then we have Alejandra Gonzalez, who goes by Sick underscore 66, so like 666. And they will be joining us shortly to talk some Dario Argento films, which is
very exciting. Yeah, pretty pumped about that. All right, so before we get into all that, we need to jump into what's on our doorstep.
Get it!
Holy cow, I almost forgot.
We'll get the door.
Pizza.
Y'all, my doorstep is pretty damn empty because I've been in... Ooh, I just smashed that. My bad. My doorstep's been pretty empty because I've been doing the movie things, but I did get to do one rewatch and one new one, so I'll start with the rewatch. Our head stylist, my casting assistant, and then she ended up becoming a producer because she just kind of threw herself into everything, Miss Angie Franklin, went to elementary school with the artist Oliver Barrett. And when the Green Room Mondo poster came out, she got her grubby little hands on one, even though she had never seen the movie, because she went to, you know, elementary school with this guy. And she's like, hey, I've always wanted a piece of your art, and I'd love to get this one. I think it's really cool. So she got one, and she framed it. It looks beautiful. And she went to hang it up, and we all were like, well, have you even seen this? And she's like, no, I just really liked the artwork. I'm like, all right, man, you're watching it. So despite Angie working on Powerbomb and being around a horror movie set for the last 2 weeks, she is the best person to watch horror movies with. Like, hands go over her eyes, like, she screams, she gasps, like, knees come up to the face. Like, she's a grown-ass woman, and she still does this. It's incredible. So we watched Green Room, and one, I forgot how amazing that movie is. Like, I mean, I didn't forget it, but, like, rewatching it, it's just so fantastic. But watching it with somebody who's never seen it is so much fun, because you know all the things that are going to happen, but watching them react to it is 10 times better. So that movie still has such a fantastic rewatch. Macon Blair is still so goddamn good. But that was a lot of fun. As far as my new goes, I caught Baby Driver, and I fucking loved it. I had a lot of fun with it. And I think that Baby Driver is very similar to, like, jukebox musicals. And that, like, because when you have a, like, the difference between, like, an actual, like, a traditional musical and a jukebox musical is that jukebox musicals are when the music already exists and they're building a storyline to kind of, like, give it a through line. So, like, Tommy, Mamma Mia, Across the Universe, jukebox musicals. Baby Driver is, like, a jukebox movie, almost, and that all of the music in this existed, but it's a character in itself, and it's kind of acting as a through line for the entire story. And that was really interesting to me. Like, I love the syncopation in a lot of Edgar Wright's films, like, especially, the Don't Stop Me Now scene in Shaun of the Dead, I think is probably my favorite scene in that whole movie. And then Baby Driver is almost entirely a movie of that. And that was a lot of fun to me. I don't, like, I completely understand the criticisms that the film is getting, but it was just so much fun, and the music is so infectious. Like, we were all screaming bell bottoms in between all of our takes on set. But yeah, that's it. That's all I got.
Very sweet.
You're sweet.
Thanks. Thanks, Brian.
Aw.
All right, I'll go ahead and go. Speaking of Ty Sheridan in Baby Driver, I finally got around to watching Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse.
Wait, Ty Sheridan in Baby Driver?
Ty? He's not in Baby Driver. Like, who are you talking about?
Just like the guy in Baby Driver.
No, Baby Driver has, the dude has a weird name.
Are you talking about John Hamm?
No.
No.
Or are you talking about Ansel Elgort?
Yeah, you're talking about the Ansel Elgort. The,
No, he looks just like the guy in Baby Driver.
Ty Sheridan?
Yeah, Ansel Elgort looks almost just like this guy that I watched in Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse. Like the same mouth.
I will give you that. Ty Sheridan does look like him. I'll give you that. But no, Ansel Elgort's the kid from Fault in Our Stars.
Hey, you know, hey, whatever. Actors' names. Not my strong suit. I swear, can't name.
We know
they're the same guy because I put in the movie. I'm like, oh, that's the Baby Driver guy. All right, cool. It's gonna be, you know, I don't know. So never mind. Well, anyway.
Good segue.
It's the Screamcast where Sean fucks up all his segues. All right. Well, anyway, I watched the Scout's Guide to the Zombie Apocalypse, and if I was a 16-year-old, I probably would have loved the shit out of this film. I kind of got in that headspace through the film, and I laughed a lot. I think it's a fun little zombie comedy, and people were kind of like getting on his case about being juvenile, and I'm like, well, they're all sophomores in high school. Of course, it's going to be juvenile humor in this. And of course, they're going to be fixated on boobs when they see them. They're like 16. So I thought it was a lot of fun. Good little time waster.
I think it's a good transitionary horror film.
Yeah, totally. I like it quite a bit.
Yeah, that's a good one when, like, when your kids get a little older before you want to start diving them into hardcore stuff, you know?
Yeah. All right. We haven't done What's Under Dressup in so long. I'm like trying to look through my list. I'm like, oh crap, because I've
Another fun movie to watch with to pair up with Scout's Guide is Freaks of Nature.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
Yeah, that one's a lot of fun to watch. Pair them up because they both have that similar tones. They're both really silly. They're both really fun for me. I like them quite a bit.
Very nice. Next up, I watched Gore Verbinski's A Cure for Wellness. I don't want to talk too much about it. I think it's a movie that it came and went in the theaters, which is an unfortunate. I think its running time was kind of its demise. I feel like it goes maybe a half hour. There's a half hour too much in there if it would be trimmed down, which is the case kind of for most of – I mean, Gore Verbinski – other than like The Ring, he did like the Pirates of the Caribbean movies and everything, and like those run way too long. Like he needs to get a better editor or be able to edit himself better. I don't know, but for what it is, like it's a. I just said for what it is. Thank you, people who are keeping track. It has a lot of good atmosphere. I thought all the acting was great. It gets bonkers near the end, which is I always love it when a movie will go bonkers. And so if you're a fan of kind of atmospheric and psychological horror, kind of like Shutter Island or something like that. I think there's a lot for you there. Just settle in. It runs a little long, but I was never bored through it, and I dug it for the most part. I got around to watching The Belko Experiment, and this was written by James Gunn. People, for some reason, were thinking that like James Gunn directed it. So I think people were like, oh, James Gunn's back in horror, and there's a lot of expectation on the film. I think it's a serviceable B-movie set in an office. I think working in an office, I feel like they get a lot of things right. But it's, you know, I thought it was a lot of fun for that. And, you know, it's a good little one-time watch, I think. Brad, have you watched that yet?
What is it?
The Belko Experiment.
Oh, yeah. No. I haven't watched it. You cut out when you said the name. I'm having a tough time on my end, but just keep going. No, I have not seen The Belko Experiment.
Okay. Well, you're the first person, I think...
You're the first person I know that has said, hey, it's okay. So...
Yeah. Huh.
Okay. Whatever.
I mean, we'll just let you do your thing. You go ahead.
Yeah. All right. I think that is it. Oh, I watched the Ghost in the Shell remake and didn't hate it.
Oh, wow. Another one. First for everybody.
Surprisingly. I think it's a well done, slick looking sci-fi flick. Horribly miscast with the lead, but there's a lot. If you're a sci-fi fan, like, there's a lot to chew on. Like, I always have the original anime, which is fine. I love it. That's in my top 10 films of all time. But, you know, for them trying to do this live action, I think they did an all right job. And I think hopefully it'll bring a lot of people into the world of Ghost in the Shell, and people will start discovering the anime as they go along and everything. So, yeah, I didn't hate it. I was surprised.
Wow.
And that's it.
Cool, Sean.
Yeah. Wow.
That's a really...
That's not high marks. Like,
cool
I didn't
story,
hate it.
Bro.
That's not like a high mark. But All right.
I don't know how
All right,
much...
Brad, you have less than 15 minutes. Go.
I don't even know if I have anything I can really talk about, because I've been doing the Fantasia stuff. I watched, oh boy. Well, I did, I've actually never seen pretty much the Saw films. I stayed away from them, on purpose because, I watched the first one and I do enjoy it. I watched the second one. And I think after that I was pretty much done. But Willow has been watching this body painting makeup show, and I guess they had a horror episode, and I guess they were referencing Saw. So she asked about it. She's like, hey, there's these movies called Saw that it sounds really interesting, something I would like, you know. And I said, okay, cool. I don't know what it's called.
Is it Skin Wars?
It possibly is. So I was like, all right, we'll go ahead and watch them. So I think I've watched all of them. I can't tell because they all run together. It's the same goddamn movie wrapped up fucking six times. Like, they're all, I mean, I tell you what, it's really hard to believe that, these have went on that long. It seems like they create plot holes on purpose in order to try to fill in the gaps for the next movie. Certain things that are okay about them, but relatively, I mean, I don't... It's crazy that they stuck around that long. I mean, obviously, they made a lot of money. People enjoyed them. But, I mean, you were having, like, I was talking to Sean about it. The only reason probably they were so successful is because they were coming out in October. Every year in Halloween. That seems like it could be a fun tradition for a lot of people. Other than that, I've been watching a lot of Fantasia stuff I'll be covering over the next couple episodes coming up. Can't talk because I don't know if they've premiered all that much. And then, I'll cover those next episode.
Well, Josh Obershaw now joins us with the news. Josh, what's up?
That's right. Here once again, your roving reporter. I'm out here sweating my balls off again in good old Central Valley, California.
Oh, yeah.
I've got two bottles of water in front of me trying to keep cool out here.
Oh, that's right, because you're doing this. You're recording out in the garage, aren't you?
Yeah.
Keeping it classy, folks.
Always.
Big budget. Spare no expense.
So, guys, I hate to start this on a bummer note. This is the kind of news week that I'd hope that no one hopes of ever doing. But this past Sunday, we lost two figures beloved by horror fans. First one, Martin Landau, best known, of course, for his Oscar-winning performance playing Bela Lugosi in Tim Burton's Ed Wood. He died at the age of 89. And we lost George Romero.
That's a big one.
That is a really big one for me. I'm still kind of – it's still not real. Like, I'm still not used to the fact that Wes Craven's not around anymore. So yeah. This one hurts even more. Because, Dawn of the Dead was a huge movie for me when I was younger.
Yeah. What did you think of his, like, non-zombie films? I talk about this a lot, but I really love Martin. I think that one's my favorite of his non-kind of zombie attempts.
Martin is so, so good. That is one I finally got around to in recent years, and I was just blown away by that one. But I think – but as much as Dawn meant to me as it did in my teens and my 20s, if there's one George Romero film that pretty much sealed the deal as me being a horror fan at a very young age, that is Creepshow. That is the one that made the biggest impression on me when I was too young to be watching Creepshow. I mean, I must have been about 5 or 6 when I saw that movie, and I just loved every single second of that film, and I still love it to this day. It's one of my absolute favorite horror movies of all time. So,
nice, yeah. I'm gonna pour a drink for George Romero.
Rest in peace, sir.
For those of you who can't stand people drinking or slurping or whatever on a podcast, I will keep the slurps to a minimum. You may hear some ice, that's about it. I promise,
right. Okay. Good news from here on out.
Okay.
Good
news from here on out. Well, no. Romero's huge. He was, I think he was 77. And I think he'd had a battle with lung cancer. I mean, he smoked right up to the end.
Yeah, he did. Seems like every photo we've seen of him, he's always got a cigarette in his hand.
Right, right. I mean, but, you talk about someone who's, lived over and above and beyond their years. I feel like he's had a full life, and we can say our goodbyes and know that he's he's really given us a lot, and he'll be missed. Was he working on a new film?
Supposedly finished it. No. He was trying to get a another zombie picture called Road of the Dead.
That's
it was supposed
right.
to be more like a Mad Max style zombie movie. He was trying to find funding for that, but it didn't come to fruition by the time that he passed away. So whether that does get made posthumously, if somebody takes over, I heard he was discussing it with another director in the same way that Coscarelli was collaborating with the guy who ended up directing Phantasm Ravager. His name escapes me. I'm sorry. Okay. I'm very sorry.
Well, I mean, but that would be cool. I mean, if he has a script and an idea and everything and someone else can take the reins in memory of him, that'd be pretty amazing. Like, I'd be all for
and
that,
of course,
I think.
Yeah, and the blessing from, George's wife.
Yeah.
That would be cool.
Yeah, cool. All right, well, what do you have for us in release news?
Well, speaking of George Romero, just a couple of days before he passed, Arrow announced their October slate, and one of the big things coming out that month is George Romero Between Night and Dawn. This is a box set of 3 films that he made before Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead. Those movies are 1971's There's Always Vanilla, 1973's Season of the Witch, and the original version of The Crazies.
Wow.
Obviously, Martin is missing, but who knows? Hopefully somebody will get that one out.
There's some rumors swirling around Martin, but I don't know if they can be trusted.
So, and Night of the Living Dead as well.
Right, we're hearing Criterion rumors, but like anytime you hear a Criterion rumor, you need to take that with a grain of salt. But that's like the rumblings I'm hearing, but we'll wait and see.
True, but John Squires did post something on Bloody Disgusting saying that Janus Films are going to be releasing the 4K restoration of Night of the Living Dead to theaters. And apparently there's a relationship between Janus Films and Criterion. So that's where everyone's going, aha.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, we'll see. October is not too far away, and it's one of those things that would be perfect for an October announcement. So just in time for my birthday, everybody. My birthday's in October.
Oh, shit. Throwing that
hint out. I'll put a link to my wish list on Amazon in the show notes. I'm just kidding. I won't do that. I don't beg for free shit. All right, what else we got?
All right, well, you remember that big Herschel Gordon Lewis box set that Arrow put out earlier this year?
You know, I didn't buy it because it was so goddamn big. Is that weird of me? It's like the size of a cereal box. I'm looking at my room, I'm like, I have nowhere to display this thing.
Right, well, depending on if you bought the thing or not, this might piss you off, this might not, but it looks like Arrow's going to be rolling out some of the films individually, because on October 9th and October 10th, they're releasing Blood Feast on its own for both the US and UK.
Okay.
Next up for the US and the UK, they're also releasing the blaxploitation film JD's Revenge. That's mm-hmm. going to be coming out on October 30th and 31st. Now, for the UK only, they're going to be putting out the film Miracle Mile on October 16th. And, of course, this was leaked out before the actual announcement, but The Thing is going to be a UK only release from Arrow on October 23rd.
Bone zone. That thing is almost, I think the box set version I heard was sold out. You don't quote me on that, but that one sold out really fast. Arrow's website crashed when I was trying to pre-order mine.
Wow,
And for some reason, it wasn't showing up on... It disappeared from Amazon UK. But I got mine from Zara... what's that website? Zaro? Zavi.
Oh.
Zavi. So, Zavi... .com. Is it .com? But I never ordered anything from Zavi before. They're a UK company, and they're comparable to Amazon UK. So they'll do some sort of, they'll do like Steelbook exclusives every now and then. But so I got the box set from Zavi. So we'll see. Everything was in stock, and everything got. I mean, people were, you know, double buying this, you know, buying to sell type bullshit. But. I don't know, and I don't know if they had a limit to how many you can buy, but
they do have a limit. I think it's one or two.
Okay, good.
Either one of those, but you couldn't buy any more than that.
Okay, good.
And also, I did see an update on Facebook saying it was going to be limited to 4,000 units, but I think they're going to be pushing it up to 6,000. So if you didn't get one now, better get one really quick.
Well, I know the Steelbook. There's plenty of the Steelbook. I'm such a fan of those hard box sets. Like, they're so cool that I had to get it, man. I mean, I've bought so many versions of The Thing. I have the Scream Factory version, but what tempted me was Arrow doing their own restoration of it. So I was like, shit, you know, do quality work. Oh,
sorry. Let me see. The Scream Factory restoration was 2K, I believe. And when Arrow said, hey, we're doing a 4K, everyone went just complete apeshit.
Yeah, well, people weren't really happy with the Scream Factory transfer, apparently. I don't know. I mean, I've never had a beef with the Scream Factory transfer other than Dog Soldiers. So, yeah. Cool, man. What else we got?
Well, that's it for Arrow. Next, we're going to be next. Quickly, I'm going to mention the Criterion October slate, because they're going to be releasing David Lynch's 1991 theatrical film Twin Peaks: Fire Walk With Me.
Mm.
That one's coming out on October 17th.
Now, I have the box set, the Twin Peaks box set. So what would make me want to give a shit about the Criterion release, Josh?
Okay, well, there is a new 4K digital transfer supervised by Lynch himself.
Fuck, that's it. That's it, isn't it?
Let's see, you've got the 7.1 surround sound, you got an alternate 2.0 surround soundtrack, the missing pieces, 90 minutes of deleted and alternate takes from the film, wow, which is assembled by Lynch. You've got a new interview with Cheryl Lee, got interviews from 2014, and let's see, and it just says more.
Wow.
Plus, you get an interview with Lynch from the 2005 edition of filmmaker and writer Chris Rodley's book, Lynch on Lynch. So, yeah, it was the digital transfer that did it for you, did it?
Yeah, I mean, I've been meaning to jump into this. I haven't jumped in. I've never watched Twin Peaks ever. So I bought this box set, and one of these days I need to settle in and start watching them all. I'm sure the transfer is fine, but a 4K Criterion restoration or digital transfer, I mean, that definitely is tempting. And then that 90 minutes of, supplemental cut scenes and stuff. I mean, that's from David Lynch. I mean, if it was any other director, I probably wouldn't really care. But I mean, David Lynch, like, always to me deserves some special attention just because he's so bizarre.
Exactly. I've only seen the first season of Twin Peaks. That's all of the Twin Peaks I've seen. Okay. So I haven't watched the second season yet. I know that's on Netflix, so I don't really. So I'm kind of glad I skip that on buying the box set. I mean, I can restart the show on Netflix and just get the Criterion of the film.
Cool. So, I mean, I had luckily stumbled into a sale. I think I got the whole series for like $25. Like this, this box set.
You lucky bastard.
Yeah, I mean, it was just one of those things. I was like, well, I guess I'm going to buy this thing. So.
Well, for the other film geeks out there, the other movies in the October slate from Criterion are going to be Stanley Kubrick's Barry Lyndon, the 1932 German film Vampire, Vampyr.
I've never just have to be you clear. Have you seen that? It's one of those missing pieces in my repertoire.
It is mine too. It's one that I don't hear very often when talking about the silent era.
Mm-hmm.
Compared to the German vampire film that came out 10 years earlier that everybody knows, so I'm curious about that one. Next up, the Polish horror comedy musical mashup, The Lure. That one comes out on October 10th. Vampire.
I saw a picture of that. I thought it was one of those fake Criterion things. I was like, there's no way Criterion's putting out The Lure. Because it's like it's like a bizarre mermaid musical. Is there horror in there too?
I guess so. I mean,
it's just such a bizarre film. Like, I legitimately thought it was a joke. And I was like, oh shit, they're serious. All right, wow.
Yeah, I was kind of taken by surprise that I saw that title in the lineup. I'm like, for reals?
I thought that was one that would end up, with like, maybe Scream Factory, maybe, or maybe some other smaller company. I just figured I'd see it for like, $8 somewhere. But it's cool. I mean, I haven't really seen it. I haven't really read too much about it other than seeing the trailer, and it just looked batshit crazy. And so I'm down. So,
and that is why that is one of those movies where I will not see a trailer or anything. That is one I want to go in as blind as possible. Yeah,
definitely.
And the other two films in the lineup, Personal Shopper, that comes out on October 24th, and Orson Welles' film version of Othello comes out on October 10th. Also, Barry Lyndon, I believe, also comes out on October 17th alongside the Twin Peaks movie.
Wow.
Okay. Next up. Hey, guess what? Sony's putting out a Blu-ray of 976 Evil. Can you believe that shit?
Yeah. Talk about Bone Zone. It happened when I saw that cover. I was like, what? Like, that's out of the blue. And they're doing it like a slipcover. Like,
I seriously thought that was a joke. That is the one I seriously thought is a joke, because I saw Brad tweet that on Twitter saying, holy shit, Sony's taking notes. I'm like, really? This is for real, right?
Yeah. That's a bizarre flick, man. I'm a fan just because it's so crazy. It's not an amazing flick.
No.
But if there's enough in there to chew on it for it just to be entertaining as hell. I'm hoping they keep the price below the Vestron series. Because the Vestron series,
I sure do hope so.
You know, is a bit up there.
Yeah, I know. I still haven't bought one.
I'm a sucker for punishment, man. Like, but Brad dogs those things. But like, you know, I mean, come on. I mean, it's these films on Blu-ray, and most have had some really good supplementals. Some haven't, and I was pretty disappointed. But yeah, but it's cool, man. Sony's. I mean,
Sony's
I'm trying
doing
to think
it.
Of other movies that are in there. That they have rights to, you know? I'm like, what other films?
Fright Night.
Yeah, but Fright Night's been released like a billion times.
Yeah, already. But I missed out on both Twilight Time releases because I'm a freaking idiot.
I'm surprised there hasn't been just like, if Sony just releases like Fright Night and maybe even along with the remake, someone needs to come along and snatch up the sequel and get that sorted out. But you know, for a decent price, they would knock that out of the park. But I'm really surprised Fright Night isn't as accessible. I mean, that should be as accessible as like Carrie or Christine. I mean, should be just
especially since Sony, you know, released Christine on their own.
Yeah,
and that seemed to do well. I believe.
I'm surprised they hadn't done that. Well, maybe they will. Seriously, like we're gonna start heading into October, and we're gonna. Like the mainstream kind of labels are really going to start, you know, they know where some of the money comes from. They know we're crazy horror fans. Our pockets are just burning in October. We want to buy horror shit. So
we want to stock up. There's 31 days.
Yep.
All right, lastly, let's talk about Vinegar Syndrome, our sponsor. August slate is currently up for pre-order right now. The entire set comes out on August 29th. If you buy the entire package before then, it's going to be 40% off. But if you just want the Blu-ray, DVD combo packs, that's going to be 35% off. Now, what do we get? Well, let's see. The Blu-ray, DVD combo packs are going to be Snapshot, a.k.a. The Day After Halloween, Throat, 12 Years After, which is from the director of Deep Throat, A Reflection, not a sequel, as its tagline says, and Red Roses of Passion. Now, this is the first release in Vinegar Syndrome's Sexploitation Signature series. That title is going to be limited to 2,000 copies. Now, one note about Snapshot, a.k.a. The Day After Halloween. The first 1,000 copies sold through Vinegar Syndrome are going to be housed in a double-thick slipcase designed by Speed Blur. And the DVD only releases. The first title is Intrusion, and the next title is, of course, The Peekarama, which includes Sunny and More Than Sisters.
Oh, those Peekaramas. Well, I've received a couple things from Vinegar Syndrome, including my chauffeur. So we're starting to plan for the next Vinegar Syndrome episode already. So I'm thinking we'll wait till that one arrives and we'll have a good 3 months to give some reviews on.
I can't wait for that. Hearing this, this last Vinegar Syndrome talk with Sarah Jane was pretty entertaining.
Good fun. And then, of course, BJ is going to be doing her own patron-only little mini episode. So I'm expecting her first one very soon. And I'm sure she'll of course be talking a little bit more about it in later on in the show today. So, yeah, a lot to look forward to, everybody.
Well, Sean, that's all the news I have this week.
All right, Josh, thank you very much. Side note, glad your mom is feeling better.
Thank you. Sure
everyone, we blasted out online and a lot of good karma was sent your way. So, yes. I'm really, really glad to hear that she's doing well and she's home and everything.
Yes. And I want to take this time to thank everybody on Twitter that's been sending me well wishes and all that good karma. That was much needed good karma. And I love all you guys. Thank you so much. And with that, I will see all of you next time.
Is it getting misty? Is it getting misty in here?
It's getting misty. I'm going to go now.
All right, Josh. Thanks, man. We'll talk to you next week.
See you guys later.
Now we are going to jump into some Dario Argento films, and to help us, we have a couple friends from Twitter that Brad has graciously rounded up. Is that the right way to say it?
Maybe not, but go ahead, Sean.
I'm awful at this. Alejandra Gonzalez and Stephanie Crawford join us. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, thanks for rounding us up.
I'm consistently awful at all at this stuff, but it's all good. I guess it's my thing now. It's just my thing.
You are in for a treat of an episode, Sean.
All right, so let's start off and with some introductions. So, Alejandra and Stephanie, I'll give you both a chance to introduce yourselves. Let us know, like, kind of how you jumped into horror and all that stuff, and include your Twitter name. So we'll start with Alejandra.
Hi. So I'm sick_666. Oh, wait, I messed that up. It's sick_66, and otherwise known as the Blair Bitch. My introduction to horror, I can't say because then I'll spoil the episode.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Awesome. Well, welcome. Stephanie.
Hey, I am Scrawfish on Twitter. My introduction to horror was sneaking and watching Cinemax late at night. I'd stay up, wait past Skinemax, and so I could watch, like, Rumpelstiltskin. Obviously, a passion would be born out of that, so...
Very nice. Well, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us. And I know, you know, Brad started put out the call for women to join in and everything. And it's just really been really great the response. So, Brad, how did you meet these two, or is it through all this, or?
I want to say. Maybe it feels like I've been talking to Alejandra for quite some time now, but I think that's where it gave that extra boost. Just through the twits and going through that and contacted me and trying to, you know, I get a little overwhelmed with the responses, so I can't really remember, you know, who was who and when was when at that time, because, like I said, our inbox was kind of flooded with, yeah, hey, pick me. And it's like, okay, cool, let's do it. But you got to give us a second, because I was expecting maybe this to be a month, but, you know, now it's just probably going to be a year. So, but anyways, yeah, I really don't have a time frame on that, but they're both awesome, and I'm glad to have them.
Very nice.
I am too. I'm glad to finally kick the chromosome levels over a little bit, so it's not just me trying to, like, scream at you too.
Agreed. I can agree.
Fuck the male gaze for the love of God.
Well, today we are talking about, like I said, two Dario Argento films, Phenomena and The Bird with the Crystal Plumage. Both of these have really amazing releases through Arrow Films. Phenomena is a UK only because Synapse released their version as well, which has got a lot of praise. They released a steelbook a while back. They just released their standard Blu-ray case version. So steelbook, $40, plastic case, like $17.99. I don't know. I have the Arrow titles for both of these, the Arrow releases, and they're gorgeous. So I can't wait to talk about the films, though. So, Brad, do you want to start? The Bird with the Crystal Plumage is Dario Argento's first full length, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe so. Other than, Yeah, I think it's 1970, and then 1973 was Four Flies on Grey Velvet, maybe.
Yeah,
I get confused of which one was which, what was first, but it seems like. Yeah, I think Bird was first, right?
Yeah.
BJ?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
Awesome. So let's start with that, since it was his kind of entry into film as everyone's first taste of Dario Argento. Brad, before we do that, do you want to go through and we can talk about the first Dario Argento film we've watched?
Yeah. Let the ladies go first.
Okay. Cool. Let's do.
I'll
that.
Be the gentleman in that, Sean.
I can't roll my eyes any harder at you right now. It's a physical impossibility. Oh, you're so such a gentleman. Let other people talk first so that you have more time to collect your thoughts.
Who would like to go first?
I guess I'll go first.
Cool.
Okay,
perfect.
So it's going to be no surprise that my favorite or my first encounter with Argento was obviously Suspiria. I can't say enough things about this movie, and I also don't want to say things that you guys might want to say, but I do want to say that it is streaming now, which is exciting because it'll be a lot of people's first time watching it, and you should definitely go watch it. What can I even say that hasn't been said already? It's just so captivating. And yeah, that's pretty much it. I think if you haven't seen it yet, and actually surprisingly, when I tweeted that it was streaming, a lot of people were like, I haven't seen it yet. Maybe I should watch it now. And I was like, wow, yes. Yes, you should. So definitely go do that.
Yeah, the response that got was awesome.
And also at the same time, because apparently some unspoken sin for Suspiria to be streaming and for people to watch it on Amazon Prime. I was so mad. I got so many bad replies to that. I was so surprised. Yeah, people were saying that you shouldn't watch this movie with Amazon Prime because the transfer is not going to be good. And also, I was watching it on my laptop because my TV is broken and I'm a college student and I can't really afford to fix it right now. And everyone was like, oh my God, you're watching Suspiria on a laptop. That's blasphemous. It was so bizarre. And I just wanted to say that there's nothing wrong with watching a movie the way that you can at that moment. Obviously, Suspiria is something you should watch the best way you can. But if you want to watch it really, really bad and all you have is a laptop, that's fine.
Agreed.
Yeah. Agreed.
Didn't you know there's all these rules that you need to follow to be a film lover?
A cinephile?
Did you think this was supposed to be fun?
I used to think it was fun until I got on Twitter.
Twitter's, it's a cesspool at this point. It is just,
it's so terrible. But I mean, I still watch it on my laptop and it was still the best movie ever. So
awesome. No judgment here. Stephanie, what was your first entry into Argento?
I'm sorry. It was the same thing. Awesome. I was really getting into horror, and that's one of the top titles you'll hear about.
Mm-hmm.
But I never actually heard anyone pronounce the title. So I went into a video store asking for sarsaparilla. And so, yeah, I got the rolled eyes, but I ended up getting the 3-disc Anchor Bay DVD. Mm. And that was it for me. I fell in love with Argento. I fell in love with Goblin. And I do think it would work with that title, because Argento did kind of start with spaghetti westerns a little bit. So Suspiria might work as a title because it sounds a little bit like Sarsaparilla. You guys can cut me off at any time.
Keep going.
But no. Yes, there's also Suspiria.
Yeah. BJ, how about you?
So Suspiria is my favorite, but it was not my first. My first was Opera. Mm. Because I've spoken on the show quite frequently about how I was lucky enough to have one of the last standing mom and pop video stores growing up, and they let me go in the back room, which was horror and not porn, and kind of let me do whatever I wanted. So it was very much driven by covers. And the Opera cover is so visceral with the needle under the eye. And I had to have it. And, you know, not to mention I was studying like operatic voice for most of my life. So I was like, this is going to be right up my alley. And I watched it. And I think my favorite part of Opera is seeing things presented in a horrific light that in any other movie would be kind of a throwaway, like the costume being like completely torn to shreds. Like that's a staple in most comedy films, is like, oh no, the dog ripped up the whole costume, everything's ruined. But presented through the lens of Argento, it's terrifying because it's so precise and intentional. But I really liked Opera. I wasn't 100% like balls out into it, but when I returned it, the guy was like, oh shit, no, you got to watch this one. And then he gave me Suspiria afterwards. And that was kind of the, yeah, okay, I'm sold. I'm into this. And over the years with doing this show, I've explored, I think, pretty much everything in his catalog at this point. I don't think I have any blind spots. And I've just learned to appreciate how kind of just banana cakes his brain works, mm-hmm. and how uniquely him everything is.
Very nice. Yeah, my first dive into Argento was Suspiria. I mean, I feel like if I think it was recommended to me, like if you're ever starting to research Argento or want to jump in, and Suspiria is always top of the list. But yeah, I fell in love with him through that, just because of the music and how he just fills the frame with color and beauty and horror, like almost all at the same time. And I'm excited to watch it. I know that the restoration is going with Synapse, and I'm just excited to see what they do with it. But yeah, don't wait for like the best presentation ever if you want to check out these films. Like, you know, check them out for sure, and then you can revisit it in a better transfer or something like that. I would never tell anybody to wait for the best presentation possible to watch a movie. That's ridiculous. Brad, how about you?
Well, I was going to piggyback off of what you said. It's kind of funny that people are like that now, where it's like, oh, it needs to be the best, then pushes up their glasses or whatever and says, actually. But mouth breathers. So I think what it is, I grew up on this stuff on VHS, so I had, you know, shitty quality. I still enjoyed the film as much as I ever have. Yeah, I mean, a theatrical experience is cool and all. Seeing it, you know, as a new transfer, like a 4K, like Synapse will do, that's going to be glorious too. But I've said this 1,000 times, and I've even argued with Sean about this. Whether it's DVD, VHS, or Blu-ray, a movie's a movie. You know, it doesn't change just the quality of the picture, but not the actual film. Sometimes you'll have a better experience, you know, maybe in a theater. But yeah, movie's a movie. My first dive into Argento was when I was
very young, probably like maybe about 11 or 12, I had a copy HBO Video put out what it was called then, Deep Red, The Hatchet Murders. And when I first got it, it has the doll on it, and the doll's head is split and the bolts and nuts are coming out. And I was like, holy shit, this is going to be like, you know, a Child's Play movie or something, or, you know, Chucky's going to pop in, or Puppet Master. And I put it in, and that's not what I got at all, but I really did enjoy, what I saw. But that moment when that doll does, like, you know, flail out of the closet and starts running, that fucking terrified me, even, you know, like a, you know, soon to be teenager. I jumped like a little baby. But yeah, that was my first dive into Argento. And then after that, I picked up Demons, because I know that he wrote that, you know, Bava directed it, Lamberto. Yeah, that was kind of my dive in, and I just kind of went nuts after that. And I think within like probably a year or two, I try to gather up every one of his films and watch it. And then I got into Westerns, like Stephanie was talking about when he was writing some Westerns and stuff. Watching with my dad. So my dad has even seen a Dario Argento film, which is pretty cool. And he doesn't watch anything crazy. He only likes prison movies and war movies and Westerns. So.
Awesome. Yeah. I mean, Argento remains, there's a lot of blind spots for me with Argento. There's a lot I've on my list. I still need to watch. And, I need to jump on that. I don't know why. I don't know why I haven't just powered through his films, because I love everything I've seen. So I don't know.
I don't know if he's a director that you can necessarily like power through. Like, I would never recommend him for a binge watch.
I guess
because his filmography. There we go. His filmography is so visually stimulating that I think if I were to sit down and just go through all of it in a short period of time, my brain and my eyeballs would just explode from all of the color contrasts and all of, like, you know, here's a giant wide open space and now here's a cluttered as fuck room. Like, oh, I think my brain would short circuit. Maybe that's just a sign of me getting old. Who knows?
Oh, no. Please.
I think if you really wanted to, like, fuck yourself up, you go backwards. Start with Dracula 3D and then work your way down.
That would actually be pretty fun, I think.
We did an Italian horror week like years and years and years ago, and it was Argento and Fulci films. And going back and forth between those two, like trying to cram it all in, like, fucked my head up so badly. Not in the sense of like, oh, this material is too scarring, but in the sense of, there's so much going on visually that I cannot process any of it anymore. It's like walking into an art gallery and then just being slapped in the face by everything.
Yeah, I don't know why I thought that it would be a good idea to watch like 7 of his movies yesterday in preparation for this. But I did it. And
that's amazing. Awesome.
Yeah, and another thing, it's tough because pretty much like after Opera, he kind of got off his rocker. I mean, Trauma wasn't bad. Sandow Syndrome wasn't bad. I think Sleepless was his last great movie. But then everything after that was just, I don't know. It felt like he was just being asked to do movies at that point. Like, I didn't feel the passion and kind of the art housiness that Argento spread up until about Opera, and then it just kind of fell off. Like, even with Dracula 3D, like the Mother of Tears trilogy. I guess it's more or less just Mother of Tears. The other stuff's good, because that's Suspiria and what was the other one?
Inferno.
Okay. And then the Mothers of Tears and, you know, his stupidly titled Giallo with Adrian Brody. There's nothing with him. Like, it doesn't even feel like an Argento film, which it's kind of depressing, because I mean, we've had that discussion about, you know, directors supposedly like losing their steam or trying something new. I think I think that's wrong. I think a lot of directors are making the same movies. It's just that we're expecting something else. You know, maybe them to grow or kind of to adapt to what, you know, that decade is making. But Argento just like fell off his rocker, I think. And just, I'm kind of dreading seeing that Sandman movie if we ever get that with Iggy Pop. But, yeah.
I think the way to look at it is that when you have somebody like Dario Argento, who's been so, I don't want to say like unique because that's kind of dismissive of his talents, but his mind clearly works in a way that no one else's does. And as you get older, trying to kind of recapture that is very difficult. Like if you look at it from the sense of like, look at like old athletes, like really, really old athletes who think they can like still do what they used to do. And it's like, nah, dude, like you're old. You have to chill out and do something a little different. But switch that with the mind. So now you're working with somebody who has such a fascinating like eye for cinema and for staging and for color, but it's getting older. And that's not to say that like, oh, he's, you know, he's losing it or he's senile or anything, but it just, you start to see things a little differently and your brain works differently as you age. And now he's, you know, this old man who used to be this crazy expressive and experimental sort of art housey guy. When you get older, that's going to start to warp into these really weird and kind of not necessarily off-putting, but maybe incoherent ways. But he's already established himself as such a tour de force that who's going to tell him no? Who's going to hold it? Who's going to tell him to pull back? It's just not going to happen. So now you're getting this like brilliant art house mind that's kind of lost it, that's just given free rein to do whatever he wants because of who he is.
Yeah. And I mean, more power to him too. I mean, he's still kicking, he's still making movies, which, you know, if Sandman was gonna premiere at Fantastic Fest, I would fucking nut in my pants and I would still go see it. You know, I know it's probably not gonna be that great, you know, counting his like last, you know, five movies, but I'm still gonna support it and still see it. I mean, Argento created now Bava created it. Argento just took it and went off with it. You know, Bava created that kind of, you know, color scheme mixed in with suspense and thrills and horror. And Argento saw that and just went ballistic with it and took it like almost he did take it to the next level. And I mean, Argento is equivalent to Carpenter and inspiring all these people to become filmmakers and, you know, have, you know, a huge success out of all these Italian filmmakers. I mean, Argento had huge success all around the world, especially, you know, in America and having American actors. Yeah. So, yeah, it's pretty sweet.
Well, let's jump into talking about 1970s, his debut, The Bird with the Crystal Plumage.
Tell me about it, eh?
What's that?
What happened? I want to know everything you saw and heard. Everything.
Monica.
Come on now, come along.
Take go of me! I'm Alberto Ranieri. She's my wife.
Excuse me.
Monica, speak to me. What happened?
Please, you're tiring her.
Monica. Oh. Dear, who did it? Who?
Now, this is his directorial debut. It is, I guess they call it the Animal Trilogy with Bird with the Crystal Plumage, Cat of Nine Tails, and Four Flies on Grey Velvet. Not necessarily because they're all connected, but because they all have animals in the title, so they'll dub it the Animal Trilogy. And this was it was written by Argento, but it's an uncredited adaptation of the novel The Screaming Mimi, and which is by Frederick Brown. So there was an official adaptation in 1958 of Screaming Mimi, that's a black and white 1958 film. But yeah, he basically took that story and repurposed it into his own for the bird with the crystal plumage.
Thanks, Sean, for that history lesson.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I believe this was Stephanie's film to start, so...
Cool.
Have at it, Stephanie. What was your first dive into the bird, and what does it mean to you, and do you love it?
Well, it, even though it was his first one, it was probably one of the later ones I ended up seeing, so it was interesting... seeing him get more surrealistic and then kind of go back in time and see more of the like standard giallo, just crime mystery going on. I do love it. I'm a big fan of the first three. Argento, I saw he once called it the Fauna trilogy, which I got a big kick out of. I really like that. Yeah, it's,
I thought this one was kind of funny. Did anyone see a lot of humor in this? Because I revisited it yesterday, and I could not stop laughing. It was hilarious. It's actually kind of different for Argento, which is why it's actually one of my favorites.
I think there's some funny lines, like like one of the detectives or inspectors or whatever they call them, like yells like bring me the perverts or something like that.
Shortly after that, he's talking about, I don't remember who he's talking about, but he's like, oh, she prefers women, but I don't care, I'm not a racist.
No, it's the antique the antique salesman who's obviously right. gay. And and they played off as, you know, a funny, creepy gay guy, you know, the character.
Oh, I could not stop laughing. And then there was another part where he goes to visit someone and he was talking about how he was painting more mystically because he was in a mystical mood. I don't know. It was just, there was a lot of one-liners that made me crack up, and revisiting it, I was kind of surprised because I don't remember it being that funny. And also his other stuff is not funny at all for the most part. So. It was refreshing.
I also got a kick out of the romantic sad pimp in prison that he kept visiting. That was the thread I liked a lot. And yeah, you're right. There's a lot of humor in it. I think the whole painter scene, like, have you ever eaten cat?
Oh yeah.
Are you sure?
Oh God. No.
Yeah, no, it's really wonderful. Like, talk about just knocking it out of the park, like your first go.
Exactly. That's quite super impressive.
Yeah, your cinematographer ends up doing Apocalypse Now in your first film.
Wow.
Yeah, and, you know, also especially having Morricone as the, you know, composer, too. It's just like... Is insane. I actually think I mentioned that when I was watching the Blu-ray, I mentioned about, can't remember his name now, the guy that did Apocalypse Now. It's like Storaro, something like that. It's not Vincent. Storaro. It's like, yeah, something like that. But yeah, he did like Last Tango in Paris.
Red.
Yeah. Crazy, man. It's just like, that's what it jumped to. But Dick, I mean, Tracy. It's just like Dick. I'm not going to fucking mention Dick Tracy.
I like Dick Tracy. It's a gorgeous movie. Say what you want. It looks good.
But yeah, he had a great, you know, just crew with him, and it just amplified the film. So, and, I mean, and it was something major because, I mean, he's taking, you know, he's following kind of Bava's footsteps and doing these, you know, picked up, you know, the yellow book and of the, you know, like Sean said, the Scream. I didn't know that was what it was called originally. I just know it was based off one of those, you know, yellow books that came out, you know, between like the 20s and the 40s, those crime mystery novels. And
sorry, in one of the first scenes, they had them hanging right in the newsstand.
Yeah. It's super cool. It's like, just, I mean,
the beginning.
Yeah, it's just to show, like, hey, this is what this all stems from. This is what, you know, were going to do. And it created something so big. I mean, the work was already there and kind of amplifying that tradition of those crime novels that were so successful around that time. And just making movies out of these, you know, small little books is such a cool thing. So.
Yeah, it's so well done. It's actually kind of funny to me that it's the first one out of the, you know, unofficial trilogy, because I love Cat O' Nine Tails, but that one somehow feels like a first movie to me.
Yeah, I could see that. It's very standard. I still like it, but mm-hmm. I think it has to deal with just maybe his crew behind him at that point. It seems that Bird is more accomplished. And then Cat is just very more like a freshman attempt, you know, at a horror giallo film. So,
yeah, I know his dad had a big hand in just helping with the first one, even just standing up for him to the studio who was questioning him the whole time. And once Plumage is just such a huge success, I'm guessing maybe they're like, all right. You know what you're doing. Go make us some more money.
Yeah. I mean, he had what, like three or four films, like all back to back, like within like a year or two.
Like, yeah. Those first three were 70 and 71. Which okay. Is
crazy. Yeah. So Flies is his second film then, right? It Flies, then no, Cat.
Flies is the third right after Cat O' Nine.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Which I'm also a big fan of, just rock and roll, ambitious Coliseum murders. Which... Oh, man.
I can't believe I haven't seen that one. What's wrong with me?
Yeah.
No, Four Flies on Grey Velvet is pretty great.
Is that released by anyone?
Shameless.
Shameless. Shameless. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, it's a great release. It has an extended edit. So it'll switch quality for a little bit, but I don't know. I always think that adds a little bit of charm. So I highly recommend picking that up.
When I was in, New York one time at the Nighthawk Cinema, they, screened at midnight. They screened Four Flies on Grey Velvet with a live band.
Oh man.
Those are the best.
And it was the most like amazing experience. Like these guys called themselves like the Yellow Butterflies, and they fucking killed it. It was so great. And it was I've seen Four Flies, a few times. And then, you know, my buddy Josh Johnson was like, hey, they're doing this. And I was like, okay. I was like, at midnight though. Like, I mean, that sounds kind of cool and everything. I know Four Flies on Grey Velvet, but I'm already tired. I have to like leave to go to the airport like in 6 hours, like afterwards. Like, I don't know if I really want to do that. And he's like, it's a live band though. And I was fucking pumped from beginning to end. It was such a great experience. So if you're ever in New York, in general, just, if it's still there, check out the Nighthawk Cinema. It's fucking fabulous. So they do a bunch of crazy screenings like that.
But I think it's kind of interesting about Crystal Plumage too, is I guess especially compared to his later work, the kills in this movie are very tasteful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And obviously it's intentional. And I think that's what impresses me the most about this being his debut, because normally it's the other way around, is that on people's debut horror films, they just hack and slash their faces off. And this is very, very, and subtle is not the right word. I guess I'll just reuse tasteful, but it's very tasteful. It doesn't ever feel excessive. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the criticisms that he gets in some of his later works. And this also, like, we didn't touch on the score really at all. And the score of this is just atonal and really kind of haunting. Did they use this score for like Death Proof, or did I invent that in my brain?
I
heard he used it in a scene, something like
okay.
that.
Okay, that's
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, because I know that he, like, Tarantino reuses stuff, but for whatever reason, like, I believed in my brain that, like, he sampled some of it for Death Proof. So, at least I know I'm not crazy.
You're not crazy. The violence being toned down, I watched some of the special features on this, and apparently in the 70s or late 60s in Italy, they were really there's a lot of censorship going on. So to kind of not even bother with the censors, on purpose, they kept it tasteful in a sense, and kept a lot of the stuff off screen to kind of get past and not even deal with the censors, apparently.
And whether or not it was intentional, there's an art to doing off-screen deaths, and I think that he's one of the best at it.
Yeah, the first violent act, it's not even a death, but it's just stunning because, yeah, like you said, it's artful. It's such an unusual setup with the glass doors and the giant exhibits. It kind of takes your breath away, and it's so intriguing. And yeah, he doesn't even kill people right off the bat. No matter what was causing the restraint, it's so impressive.
Now, I'm glad that you brought up the glass, too, because I think that sequence that to me is kind of quintessential Argento, in that it's this, like, very large landscape, but because he's somewhat stuck behind this glass, like, there's that sense of isolation, even though there's plenty of room. And I think that's a reoccurring theme that you see in a lot of the cinematography of his films. And I don't know, it's really cool to look at the first film and see how many things would serve as a through line and what kind of defines him as an auteur. And I think that's one of them.
One thing about the glass, he didn't even try to break through the glass, though. Anyone else think about that? Like, didn't even try.
It's an art gallery, man. Be respectful.
That's like one of the only notes I took was like, at least try.
Did not break glass. Movie's dumb.
I'll give it a 5 out of 7.
No. It did not take me out. It's just funny because, you know, I don't know. I notice weird things like that. Like, because he had, like, there's like a weird tree inside. With him, at least pick that up and try once and then show you can't break it, right? I don't know. Is that a weird criticism to have?
Well, I think I realized that yesterday also, but I didn't think much of it.
It's a cool scene that is.
Do you want to film pass. Like a filmmaking standpoint from it? Why it wouldn't work and why he didn't do it is because that wide shot with her laying there and the statues in the background with him. If he would have thrown something to try to break the glass, it would have disturbed kind of the beauty of that scene because you would have had, you know, a loud break. You would have had, you know, it was more or less just it was focusing on her that was laying there rather than what he was trying to do.
Yeah.
And plus, in those situations, again, you're, you know, that's why I like movies like that, because a lot of times, you know, we can sit there and watch a movie and we can think about what we would have done. It's because we're also not in that situation. You know, it's just like when these shootings happen, people are like, oh, if I was there, I would have done this. And it's like, no, you probably wouldn't have, because you don't know what you would do in that situation. So I think it's always fun when movies don't do what obviously you would have probably done that you're thinking about. You know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah,
right. I don't know.
I have an idealistic theory, too, about it. It's one of my favorite things about Argento is, and something I love about David Lynch, is that they're really good at tapping into dream logic. Mm. So it's a little bit less in the earlier films, but still just, you know, when you're in a dream, it's just kind of like you're always a victim. You're always experiencing everything. And then you wake up and, like you said, you deconstruct, I would have done this. And it feels very much like he's just trapped in that voyeur role and there's nothing he would be able to do about it. He's it's like, sorry, you got pulled into this. This is your role now.
That's really interesting.
Stephanie gave me goosebumps just now.
Yeah, same.
No, it's a good thing. It's a good thing. So, yeah, I mean, and I think a lot of that comes from the cinematography with, still can't remember his name. So if anybody could look it up, that would be great. I'm still going to say Storaro.
No, you got it right. You got it right. Storaro.
Storaro. Yeah. Name.
Yeah.
So like even Storaro's cinematography and, you know, a later, like he did this film like a year or two later, Bozzoni's film, The Fifth Chord, which is like my favorite giallo of all time. Like he's really good at those long, intense scenes where they don't want to break it. You know, they don't want to break that trance that you're in. You know, if you're sitting there and you're thinking, oh, I would have done this. I mean, that's fine. But like sometimes for me and how like I watch movies, and this isn't a right or wrong, this is just preference, this is just something I do, is that I get so drawn into the movie that I don't think about who the killer is going to be. I don't think about what I would have done. I'm not trying to figure out the ending. So when the ending happens, usually I'm like taken by surprise. I'm like, oh shit, you know? And, yeah, I mean, I don't pause the movie or think, who can this be? That eliminates this person, that person, this person. I mean, it's pretty obvious in Scream who the fucking killers are. But when I first was just sitting in the theater, I was like grabbing my hair. I was like, oh, my God, this is fucking incredible. You know, so I don't know. It's just one of those things where I don't want them to do the obvious. I like that. And like Stephanie said, it's very much in a lot of Italian films, especially in the 70s and 80s, there are dreamlike kind of states. And I like that theory and everything like that. So I dig it.
I wanted to pose another question, especially to the ladies here, in regards to how some of the women characters act in this film when they're being pursued by the killer. One in particular, the girlfriend, I forget her name, like she's in their apartment or somewhere and the killer's trying to break through the door, and all she does is like flail around and scream and cry. And I know that if my wife was watching this, she would be like, get up, bitch, you know, like do something. Cause my wife's very physical and would be like, I'm going to, you know, she would definitely put herself in that scenario and be like, I'll take that fucker down. How do you view like scenes like that? Do you think it was just him trying to show this character or something else? Just,
I mean, I didn't really think about it much because I don't know how I would react in that situation because I've never been in that situation, but I'm pretty sure I wouldn't really be logical enough to come up with some like elaborate plan to destroy this killer. So I'm not sure. Actually, that's an interesting question.
I've always viewed it as kind of a reflection of the time and culture of, you know, where he's from, and that it's less of like, I'm intentionally going to make this like a dumb female character who doesn't know how to fight back, and more so that sort of archetypal performance is just such a standard in Italian cinema at the time, regardless of genre, that I think that's just kind of what he knows. And it's what make, and that it makes sense in that world. Like, you know, you said so yourself, like the dude didn't break the glass. So I think that it's less of a sexism thing and more of a, you know, people don't know how to respond in these situations sort right. of thing.
Okay. Stephanie?
Yeah, I think when I watch certain films in certain time periods and from certain cultures, I automatically kind of adjust my expectations. So I'm not sitting here like, no, she should pull out a gun somehow. But yeah, and I'm a big fan of a lot of Italian films from the 1940s to 1960s in different genres. And there are a lot of issues with how women are treated there. So I think I actually focused a lot on how warm and loving his relationship with his girlfriend Julia was. Mm-hmm. Just like involving her and like, hey, what do you think about this piece of evidence? And I think I actually focused on that more. Everything else, I don't know. Maybe I'm numb to the conventions in that way at this point.
I don't think it was anything glaring. I was just curious as I was rewatching it. And I think even the first time I saw this movie, I didn't really think about that. But that's interesting you bring up that their relationship, because it is – he does. It is a pretty great on screen relationship. Like they definitely have chemistry, and it's funny because she wants to kind of just relax and, you know, have a good time with him, but he gets wrapped up in the case and trying to solve this, and it's kind of fun seeing the frustration kind of brought out of that with her, you know, as opposed to like the man being frustrated that the woman's not giving him attention. Like I thought they handled that relationship pretty well. What did everybody think about that?
Yeah, that the scene where she's thrilled that they're about to leave the country is adorable. She's like, get over here. We're going to make out. We're finally leaving this cabin.
Is that when they're the other, is it detectives in the room?
Yeah, he's like, yep, I'm going to think about this audio tape. You two, all right, right. I'll take it. You guys have fun.
Yeah.
Another funny moment. Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
And then there was one point where he was like laughing because he was so excited that he finally made a connection, and she's like, what the hell, we were about to leave or something. She like throws something at him and he just laughs. That relationship is great.
Yeah. All right, well, we can move into phenomenon in a little bit. Any last remarks about The Bird with the Crystal Plumage? I think if you haven't seen this, if you've haven't watched it, I definitely would highly recommend it. I first saw this, I had the Blue Under, I think it was Blue Underground, the Blue Underground DVD, which I would say if you still have that, hold on to it, because there's a commentary that didn't make it into the Arrow Blu-ray. So if you're someone who's kind of a completist with special features, hold on to that one. There was another release of Bird with the Crystal Plumage that wasn't restored that I own. That was on Blu-ray. I forget who released it. Some
VCI.
Yeah. I took the Blue Underground DVD and then the VCI set, and I put all the discs in one package. So I'm holding on to that because of the Blue Underground stuff. But yeah, this release by Arrow is just gorgeous, fantastic. It has a really great set of essays in there and a cool poster. So if you haven't picked this one up, it's a high recommend from me.
Cool, Sean.
Yeah.
Anybody else? Last words on Bird with the
Crystal Plumage? The only last words is not really maybe a starter conversation thing. It's just, you know, another thing that I love about Argento and his work is you have to compliment his editor, because his editor he used pretty much, I think, on almost every single one of his films is Franco. Man, I am not. I should have written down notes. Richelli? What'd you say, Stephanie? Yeah.
Richelli.
Yeah, he just knows how to fucking edit a movie. He can keep, like, to hit the comedy right, to hit the suspense right. You know, just it feels like just everything was just so magical on that set that everything, it feels like everything was flawless. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just every one of his shots, and in this film alone has inspired so many people. Like when I watch it, I mean, the very first person that pops in my head whenever I'm watching A Bird with a Crystal Plumage is Pedro Almodovar. It seems like this would be something that Pedro Almodovar would just drool over and has so much inspiration from. So, but anyways, it was just that.
Pretty cool. All right, well, let's jump in to 1985's Phenomena.
Yes. The fawn. Very particular wind. Typical of this part of the country. It comes from the Alps. The blasts of warm air cause snow avalanches. While it blows, there are those who say it causes madness.
Now, this was starring Jennifer Connelly and Donald Pleasance, as well as Daria Nicolodi. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Nickelodeon. Yeah. Does anybody think that actually Argento and her were ever together at any time?
I would say so.
Because they worked together quite a bit, and she was actually, I believe she wrote the screenplay for Suspiria.
Oh.
If I'm not mistaken, Stephanie probably knows that answer.
I thought they co-wrote it.
Me, man.
Well, you're the one like dropping fucking knowledge like here and there.
They wrote it together.
Oh, okay.
Well, Phenomena focuses on Jennifer Connelly. She's an American student who gets sent to the Alps or Switzerland, I think, to a boarding school. While she's there, she discovers that she has psychic powers and she's able to communicate with insects and mainly flies. And she and Donna Pleasance and a monkey and a special fly decide or use their skills to pursue a serial killer who's killing girls around the school. Is that a good? How am I doing on the synopsis? Am I getting better?
What'd you say?
That was actually kind of a really amazing description of this movie.
Yeah, it's pretty good, Sean. I ain't gonna lie.
A young girl and
not all loose cannons.
I adore Phenomena. I love this film. I'm a huge fan of Jennifer Connelly. I think she's a fantastic actress, and like she has acting chops ever like through this and then Labyrinth, like as a young woman, like, she's had to have been like 15 or 16 in this film. And then all the way through, like she's just always, I feel, on point, like just a really great actress. And then, you know, Donald Pleasance showing up in this. And it's just fantastic. And then I love anything that gets batshit crazy, and the bugs and the monkey are just icing on the cake for this, which is why I got so like upset when one of our listeners did he tweet out a picture of the first essay in this little booklet in the Arrow set?
Yeah.
Of this
Josh Hurtado, this guy that fucking wrote this essay. Like, I forget the joke that I made. He basically just kind of shits on Phenomena, like, the start.
Mikkel J. Coven. Even diehard Argento fans must agree, Phenomena is minor Argento. Fuck you, Mikkel.
What?
Yeah, I agree with that statement. What you said, not what you said.
That's a pitch.
This essay is about, like, gross out horror. And it's like, oh, it focuses on maggots and just gross. Look, it's not that gross. It's just, it's such like a derivative essay that's just writing off this film, and in such a lovingly created package that Arrow's given us, like the first essay is just so condescending towards the film.
It's condescending. It's pretentious. This guy, he wrote this giallo book a few years ago called La Dolce Morte, and it's a vernacular cinema of the Italian giallo film. And it's the most pretentious, like, boring fucking book that exists out there. And it's not even passionate. There's nothing behind it. And even that essay in the Phenomena book, I just hate it, because I made a joke of the conversation between Coven and Arrow. It was like, he was like, can I do Deep Red? And they were like, no. Can I do Bird with the Crystal Plumage? No. You want to do Phenomena? And he's like, nah, okay. You know? Like, that's what it felt like. And it's just, like, to start off an essay like that to begin with, and it feels like he never speaks highly. I honestly, I didn't read the whole thing, because I got, like, two pages in.
I did, and I started to see red.
Yeah, I think I got two pages in and was like, number one, I'm not really learning anything, and I'm kind of done with this. You know, does it get better? Does he ever speak highly of the movie?
No.
Okay, yeah, then I didn't really miss anything.
No, I mean, Phenomena is so great. It's so crazy. The music drops are just ridiculous, with Iron Maiden and Motorhead. Like, Motorhead appears in, like, it's supposed to be kind of a sad scene. Like, there's ambulances there, like a murder has happened.
I love this.
Motorhead shows up.
This is my favorite soundtrack besides Suspiria, obviously, because of the metal, and it breaks my heart that they took it out for Creepers. Ugh, it made me so much.
So who can speak on the history with the edits? I watched the international version. It was cut down for the U.S. release by New Line Cinema for Creepers. And then there's the Italian version, which is a little bit longer. Has anybody viewed all the different cuts of this?
I think so. I know my first introduction to Phenomena was Creepers. I had a Creepers VHS. I watched it. I still love the movie. And then later on, when it came on DVD from, I think, like, you know, Blue Underground, I was like, what is this? And I bought it, and then I realized it was the same fucking movie. But yeah. And then I guess the original Arrow Blu-ray is the integral cut, which I think is what is the preference, which is like the 107 minutes. And Creepers is like 80 minutes.
Yeah, they cut it down so much. It was kind of a lot to handle the first time I saw Creepers, because they didn't give you any like breathing room the way that, you know, the original cut does. But I still enjoyed it. I mean, my experience was different. I saw Creepers second, so the U.S. edit afterwards, and I didn't like it as much as I thought I would. I prefer the original.
Yeah, no, I definitely prefer the original as well. After experiencing that, I'll never go back and rewatch Creepers, because when you take scenes out of an Argento film, you're cutting up pieces of a painting, it seems.
Yeah, so I agree completely.
I don't want to see that shit.
Yeah, the pacing.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead.
No, it's just the pacing, to me, it takes out the dreamlike quality, which is one of the best aspects to Phenomenon, in my opinion, besides the monkey.
Oh, that poor monkey.
The monkey is amazing. Like, the animal wrangling in this film is like stuff of legend.
Like, I don't want to spoil what happens, but, like, I've never been so sad for a monkey in my whole life other than this movie. Like, fuck your Harambe memes. It's all about that monkey and Phenomena.
Well, you know, if I remember correctly, in Troy Howarth's book, if you want to read a giallo book, Troy Howarth wrote two or three of them, and they're fucking amazing. So if you want to learn some stuff about giallo, if you're new to it, anybody out there, pick up Troy Howarth's book. He's such an amazing person, and knows his knowledge is like crazy, crazy good. That monkey fucking bit Jennifer Connelly, like, in real life.
His finger?
I think it like bit her finger off, or like she had to be rushed to the emergency room. So,
oh shit,
fuck that monkey! Fucking stop biting little method. Jennifer Connelly. So, I if anybody can look that up and verify that, or if that's known anywhere, I think that's in Troy Howarth's book. And yeah, that monkey bit her finger, and they had to take the monkey off set.
I'll say that probably means that monkey was put out to pasture after the filming was completed.
Oh no!
Because that's usually what happens. Ugh! What a bummer. I mean.
Maybe, well, no, let's just say this. Donald Pleasance found out about it, and he saved the monkey.
Oh, really?
And he ran. No, I'm just saying that. I'm making up a side story. He found out, and he broke into a compound with Tony Moran, and he stole the monkey and lived with Donald Pleasance until the day he died. And the monkey died the same day as Donald Pleasance did, because he couldn't go on without him.
And now they're buried together, and we can visit them. Perfect. Okay, so, I buy that. I buy that for a dollar.
I'm trying to find the information about that, about the monkey. I couldn't find it, but I'm finding more interesting things about this film. Like, Jennifer Connelly was 13 years old at the time of filming. And the original script called for her to be naked in some scenes, and her parents, of course, refused.
Like refused. A lot of Italian cinema.
I was going to say, I'm not surprised that's a cultural thing. It sounds awful, but it's...
No, I know. I just don't think they don't... I mean, it's not the same. And, like, but still, it catches me off guard every fucking time. And I'm like, ugh! It's the noise I make.
Argento flew out to the States to show her parents that he was serious, that he really wanted her for the film. He agreed to change the script. And then her parents allowed Jennifer Connelly to appear in the film.
Thank God.
Yeah,
because she's young. Jennifer Connelly is just so quintessentially perfect for this film because she has all of the features that serve well in giallo film. She's got like the really, really pale skin. She's got the piercing eyes, but like the dark eyebrows. So then you can't look away from them. And that's like she's what like a giallo filmmaker would like write on a piece of paper as like the perfect female lead. And like, she has everything in it.
Yeah. I guarantee if, Asia was a little older, that's who would have been in this.
No question.
You know, like the first time that Asia got naked was in her own dad's film, which is another weird fucking thing, but hey, I'm not judging. I guess
Europeans, you know.
Well, I was gonna say, like, yeah, like just culturally, like nudity within, like the comfortability that they have with nudity is so much less puritanical than what we have in the States. So, like, we see that, and it's like, oh, that's gross. But like over there, like people take family visits to nude beaches, like that's family outing. Yeah.
You know, I guess that's how you got to think. It's just
it's far less sexualized. It's more natural.
Yeah,
than anything.
I think more or less. I'm thinking about the fucking, you know, creeper dudes. That's mainly what I like pops in my head is the first thing. And it's that's what sickens me. But anyways,
people are gross and the worst.
I know. But anyways.
I have information about the monkey. I found it. So,
okay.
This is from an article on Movie Pilot, but they're taking the information from that book that you mentioned. But Donald Pleasance, accompanied by a
highly
skilled and trained monkey named Tenga. So Connelly despised the monkey after it bit a small part of her finger off on the set. She was rushed to the hospital, and the missing part was reattached, but the crew swears that the monkey was cold to Connelly for the rest of the shoot.
Oh, they're trying to save him.
Yeah.
Oh. I mean, he's a wild animal, and it's not like we had such great understanding of how to wrangle these animals on set. Like, I wouldn't be surprised if it was like, we got this one from a zoo a couple weeks ago, and we taught it how to say sign language things. It knows four words. Let's put it on screen.
He's a star.
Well, yeah. I mean, I can go on and on about phenomena. It just gets batshit crazy. Like, it's not – I mean, just when you kind of think you have the film figured out or you think where it's going, it just goes off in a whole other direction in very dreamlike – you know, quality for sure. And, I mean, one of the all time great batshit crazy endings for me.
I have a question to impose on you guys.
Yes.
I was rewatching all these movies, like I mentioned earlier, and I noticed that around the time of Deep Red, like after that, he got more supernaturally inclined. So I was wondering if you guys prefer his more whodunit kind of stuff, or if you prefer his more supernatural stuff.
You'll find out by my top five.
Oh,
yep, same. That's what I was thinking. So my question, what is more terrifying to you? This kind of is a callback to Brad talking about watching all the Saw films earlier. What is more terrifying to you, Maggot Vat or Needle Pit from Saw?
Maggots.
Which one?
For sure.
Maggot Bath.
Yeah.
It's seen it. There's made. See, it's repulsive. I was trying to fucking eat.
When that made me itchy. I was itching throughout the whole movie.
See, I've been at the science museum around here where they have like the maggot pit with the food, and you just eat them, and like that stuff doesn't bother me.
What?
Yeah, you can eat the like eat like bugs and stuff at the museum.
Do you know about cricket flour?
Yeah, I've had cricket flour.
That's like the new thing. The new thing now is that if you can grind up crickets into a fine powder and it will have the same properties as flour. Like, you can bake cakes with it, but rather than getting, like, the carb of flour, you'll get protein.
I'll try it.
Bro.
Yeah, it's like this. Yeah, so everything you eat is just, like, loaded with protein because you're eating bugs.
See, I've eaten, like, I eat bugs, and, like, not on a daily basis, but if someone, like, has it, like, hey, this is cooked up, you know, deep-fried tarantula, I'm like, all right, yeah, let's try that.
Can the title of this episode just be, I eat bugs, Brad Henderson?
so the needles don't bother me either, but I could see that, you know, I would be more terrified of needles than I would maggots. Any maggots don't bother me at all.
Stab me with a million needles. Do not put me anywhere near maggot. I will gag and, like, throw up on myself and then be grossed out because I've puked on myself and I'm covered in maggots. And then I just probably hyperventilate and die.
So, bot flies?
Baby.
Oh.
Ugh.
I pass out every time I get my blood taken, so I'm not a fan of maggots, but I gotta go with them.
I have one more cricket thing.
Jesus Christ!
There's this company. When I was trying to get in shape and stuff, I was trying to find, like, protein bars, and there's one company that does, like, cricket flour for their protein bars, and, like, they had, like, the worst texture. And then I had recently seen Snowpiercer, and all I kept thinking about was those, you know, protein bar, you know, protein sticks that were made out of the crushed cockroaches whenever I was eating those protein bars. So I threw the rest of the box away.
One of my customers at work is this company that their whole goal is to teach children about the protein in bugs and why we should be eating bugs rather than, like, eating flour, and that's going to help childhood obesity. So just picture one of those, like, why reading is fun, like, children's posters you would see in the library with, like, bright colors and, like, everything is written in crayon with, like, a backwards R every once in a while. But it's, like, reasons eating crickets are fun. And, like, the first three are, like, highly educational. And then number four, it's like, because isn't it cool to face your fears and tell people you eat bugs? I'm like,
oh my God.
What? Like, that sounds like something the bad kid would say in, like, a Dare sketch. Like, isn't it cool to do drugs? Like, what the fuck is happening?
Are you afraid to face your mortality or something?
It's ridiculous. So, yeah, phenomena. Bugs. Lots of bugs.
So, I have a maggot story that might gross you out, BJ.
I'm going to mute myself so I don't gag.
All right. So, I worked in animal rescue for about 2 years. We would be the group that would go, like, if people were taking away a pet from abuse, or there was a call about, you know, some feral kittens or anything like that. So we had this call about a dilapidated house where this it was in just in a neighborhood. The houses went to shit. And people reported that the cats were living in the house, and the house was basically falling apart. So we went in the house, and the kittens were inside of the walls. So we had to, like, tear open the walls. So I got into that crawl space. And that way you could crawl up the wall, like people under the stair style, and actually get into the attic. So there was these kittens that were, like, lining up, and I was afraid they were going to fall, like, off and go down into the wall, and that would have been terrible. So it's, like, crawling, and I reach up to grab, like, and pull myself up, and my hand just, like, grabs something, and it's mushy, and I had to grab myself.
Bye. Bye. Goodbye, cruel world.
I had to grab because I was, you know, going to fall, but it was a bird that was basically just gutted and hollowed out, and I squeezed it. And when I squeezed it, the maggots and funk came out of the bird and hit me, like, in the face. My mouth was open. And I'm just, like, covered in these guts, and all I'm worried about is saving this little fucking cat. And so, like, I quickly, like, reach up, basically strangle the cat and yank it, and then fall back down And, you know, all the cats survived.
Okay? Was the cat okay?
Cat was okay. And
man,
people look at me.
Man, fuck that cat. That cat can die. I'm getting the fuck out of that house. I'm going to burn it to the ground. I'm out.
And, yeah, that was still not afraid of maggots, but that was my worst maggot experience. Because it was – I don't think I've ever smelled or tasted something that foul.
Ew.
Yeah. Low to the face.
Oh, yeah. Disgusting.
So, hey, save some kitties, though.
Well,
that's good.
Good job, Brian.
All right. Our dad has a weird fascination with maggots. The Suspiria scene made me uncomfortable also. It just, ugh.
I mean, Argento loves bugs, and I think this one is like, he got all his bug fetish out for sure. In this.
Oh, for sure.
One thing I like about Argento is kind of, he loves, and which is why when I watched A Bird with a Crystal Plumage, I was surprised there was no glass breaking, but he loves like things shattering through glass. I remember there's a scene in Suspiria, and then there's
it's equivalent to Tarantino's trunk scenes.
Yeah.
He just does it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's great. And
that's his daughter, by the way. Or, yeah, I think it's his other daughter, right?
Is she in Phenomena as well?
It's not Ozzie. I thought it was the other daughter.
Okay.
Is she's the one that plays in Demons. She plays the girl in the green dress. Who is that? It's an Argento family member. He puts his whole entire family in movies.
I'm gonna consult IMDb. I know you hate me doing this. See, and you give me shit for consulting IMDb, but sometimes you have to, man. Fiore Argento. Nope.
All right. Who is that? Is that his other daughter?
I believe so. Her last name's Argento.
But yeah, I know, but he does families and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, her head goes daughter of Dario Argento.
Backwards through the glass.
Noah. Is that Noah?
I'm gonna play fast.
What, Noah?
Hi, Noah.
This happens every episode now.
What'd he say? What does he need? He needs another Otter Pop.
Danny and Jacob aren't going to play, so this is a big deal. Noah, come here to the microphone and talk into the microphone for me real quick. Come here.
Talk about Phenomena,
just say,
Noah.
Just say,
say the movie Phenomena is awesome. Come here. Come on, just say something real quick. Say hi. Now you're shy?
Hi.
Oh,
hi. Talk about bugs.
Noah, what do you think about bugs?
No!
Sounds like BJ.
That's the correct response.
Okay, go. Hey, you need to go ask mommy, okay? Daddy's almost done. You need to go ask mommy.
Bye, Noah.
Adorable.
All right, shut the door. Thank you. Okay. Meanwhile, John Portanova is like, fuck. Kids, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, man, his wife's pregnant, so
John, you're totally gonna know.
Yeah,
you will know.
He's got a little baby on the way, so he's got to deal with that shit in a couple years.
This happens. So. Oh gosh, someone else on Twitter, AM Novak. She was talking about how kids, are always interrupting, her kids interrupting her, I believe, on Twitter and podcasts, and I'm like, yeah, it happens all the time.
Yeah,
that was a direct attack on me. I would like to mention. It probably wasn't, but we were recording a podcast the other day, and my dog started to like breathe really heavily.
It happens. This is podcasting. We're just hanging out, talking stuff. Shit's gonna happen. Okay.
Yeah, give us more money for Patreon so we can get a studio, one that's in three time zones at the same time.
Yeah.
And then you won't have to worry about children or dogs or ambulances or any of that shit.
Yeah, but she's great. I think she was just joking.
That's she's totally cool.
Oh, yeah, no. I'm referring to, like, our normal mouth breather idiots that say dumb shit to us.
All right, so,
you have three girls this time? Three girls?
That's too many girls. Why do you have so many,
girls? You have two girls,
I've never even met
boys.
A girl.
Oh, God.
Hey, what are you guys going to have a bunch of dudes on? Chef three dudes. Need more dudes.
That's what it's like, man. I tell you, this—that's what, like, you know, to piggyback off what Alejandra said earlier is just like, you know, of course, it's all dudes that come forth and criticize it, you know, BJ deals with this too, is that no matter what you're doing, there's going to be something wrong with somebody else with what you're doing, whether you're streaming it, whether you're watching a VHS tape, whether if you're watching it on Blu-ray, oh, you don't have this version. It's like, stop trying to be an elitist, because it doesn't work. It just makes you look like a fucking idiot. And when you're doing it publicly on Twitter, you look like even a bigger tool. Like, I mean, you know?
I'm just over here trying to blow my way into more jobs. I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
BJ. BJ.
God. Yeah, no. Actually, speaking about Anya, which is AM Novak, she does this column called Video Nasties, and she did an Argento film, and she got a lot of responses about how it wasn't a deep enough cut, and it should have been more like one of his more obscure movies. And that's just the worst, because these movies, like, as is, aren't super accessible. It's kind of
every Argento film, like, super popular. Like,
I can't wait for us to all do our top fives, and then when, like, somebody doesn't mention one of his shittier films, like, oh, you guys forgot this. No, we didn't forget it, dumb fuck.
You didn't mention his student film in 1967 that he did at college. He shot on 8mm, and I only have it, and you don't. And you didn't mention it.
You can't really consider Demons, because he didn't really direct that. I mean, he produced it and wrote it, but he didn't direct it, so that doesn't really count.
Yeah. It's so frustrating. I feel like every day, I mean, as a woman at least, some guy is, like, in your mentions talking about how, well, actually, okay, but this guy also directed, like, I don't know, Phenomena. I bet you haven't seen that, when it's, like, one of his more popular movies, and he definitely so annoying.
Right. Dummies.
Everyone.
Cool, let's do top five.
Stop telling everyone how to watch their shit. All right, yeah, let's jump into our top five. Argento, any last words about Phenomena?
I just want to say that this would be a phenomenal double feature with Carrie, because they do have that element of, like, coming of age and then coming into your own powers. And there's that one scene in the school where she walks in on them kind of, like, reading her stuff and tormenting her and bullying her, and then, like, the swarm of bees, or what was it? It was flies, right?
Flies. Man, that seems incredible.
Yeah.
So that reminded me a lot of that intro scene in Carrie where she's in the shower and then she's getting all these, like, tampons thrown at her. Wait, no, was that in the original? Or was that in the remake?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, it's in the original.
Okay, good.
Shot, yeah.
Okay. Plug it up.
That'd be a great feature.
Plug it up.
And then,
that was my first horror slumber party movie. Ugh.
Wow.
Wow. But yeah, and then, you know, she uses her telekinesis, or, you know, not intentionally, the same way that it happened in Phenomena. So I think it's a great double feature. I definitely suggest you do that. And yeah.
Very cool. Yeah, I think this Arrow box set is amazing, with the exception of that one essay. They're probably sick of me. I've been tweeting them, like, tagging them in the tweets, making fun of that article. Sorry, Arrow. Sorry, I'm a dick.
Oh man, the booklet guy is tweeting again.
Yeah, there's that guy.
You know, like, the booklet guy. Yeah.
But this, you know, is great. I love that.
You know, Arrow listens to this show, right? Though, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, Francisco and Ewan listen to this show, so we're gonna get shit.
That's fine. It's fine. I'm being honest. But
I love what they're
doing with these boxes. They're so sturdy. They're so great. It looks like the Thing special edition that they're the limited edition is going to be the same kind of sturdy box. I love how they put these together.
Are you masturbating right now?
Like, it's, we got some
boxes.
Box corn. Box corn.
Can you put your dick in the box?
Yes.
You can try.
You tried. Oh!
I don't know who tweeted it the other day, but it was like, I'm such a, like, I'm a cinephile. Is that why my dick's in the VCR right now? Or, like, something to that effect. And I, like, laughed for a good 10 minutes. I'm like, God, that's good. That's real good.
But the Aerosat's really great. I've heard a lot of really great things about the Synapse set as well. I'm not sure about if Arrow was using Synapse's transfer. Does anybody have any information on that? Is this the same, basically the same transfer? I mean, it looks great. I just don't know if anyone's seen the Synapse version. And
I have the Synapse version, but I'm not sure if they use the same.
Okay. Well, it looks great. I mean, it's great that this got on both.
How many releases are we talking about here?
I don't know. Well, the Synapse release.
The Synapse is.
That was the first U.S. release on Blu-ray. Arrow had a Blu-ray release, and then they did a restoration on it, and then they have this new set. I have both.
Okay, yeah. The old one is just an HD master from when that was when they very first started. Like that was like in their first like 20 that they released. So, I mean, even that version is really pretty, and that's not even a restoration. Synapse always like blows everything out of the water. So does Arrow. So take your pick.
Cool. All right. And with that, let's move into our top five Argento films.
An impossible task, if you ask me, but
yeah,
totally impossible.
Not doing it.
it's kind of impossible for me because I haven't seen his entire filmography. I've seen like the heavy hitters, so I'm just gonna I'm gonna start and just run these down.
And
I'm not even.
And so we're not talking about 25 movies. Just if we mention the same one that's on your list, obviously say something. So
well,
we don't.
I'm just gonna.
I'm talking about everybody else, Sean. Not you. You go right ahead. You just start naming.
Let me go last because mine's going to be all the normal shit. I'll go last.
Oh, such a gentleman.
Since I'm such a gentleman, I will go last and collect my thoughts and have a better.
Oh my God.
Than all of you. I'm kidding. My list is bullshit. All right, who would like to go first?
I will go first, or unless BJ wants to go first. I saw her mic go on.
Oh, no, it's fine. I just moved rooms because there's dogs barking, and I needed to mute myself.
Okay. Well, so obviously my number one is Suspiria. That's not a deep enough cut, but I'm a fake fan, so. Number two is Phenomena. Number three is Bird. It was number four until I saw it again yesterday, and it made me laugh so hard that I had to move it up. Number four is Deep Red. And then number five is Inferno, which I know is like not a popular opinion, but I fell in love with the last scene of that movie so much that I just stayed with me for a long time. So
that's a solid list.
Thank you.
What, can you repeat
a little bit? What was the last?
Yeah, one? I didn't hear the last one.
So the last one is Inferno.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, I love that one quite a bit, too.
So, yeah, I tend to gravitate towards the more supernaturally inclined ones because, obviously, I don't know, and they're more, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, they're more visually intricate to me, and they're just funner to watch because they're so gorgeous. I mean, Inferno was just a trip. I wasn't even paying attention to the plot the first time because it was just so captivating.
Awesome. Stephanie, would you like to go next?
Sure. I'm doing under protest, though. Okay, number one is Phenomena. It has the screen's second greatest monkey. The first is in Buster Keaton's The Cameraman, where a monkey works in an old-time camera and shanks a gangster in the back.
Awesome.
Two is Suspiria. Sorry, but it's wonderful. There's a reason why we all love it so much.
Yeah, no apology needed.
Three is Opera, which was the second Argento I ever saw. It was actually my favorite for years, but rewatching everything, it adjusted a little bit. Four is Deep Red, and I like to think of that as part of Argento's Bad Car series. with the Great Junkie Car. One also appears in a Gray Velvet that has a Great Junkie Car as well. And someone who drives a junkie car, you know, that's the cinematic nuance I appreciate. And then five, I'm going to be defiant. I'm going to say the whole Animal trilogy.
Wow.
Cheater. Stuff so all defiant. Three in there.
That's a cheat, but I'll take it.
You know what? Come over here and stop me. Well, okay, if I had to choose, it would be the bird with the crystal plumage, but...
All right, yeah. I'll accept the trilogy. BJ.
My number one is Suspiria. Fuck anyone who says otherwise. when I finally, you know, nut up and get tattooed, the first piece that I'm getting is Chris Garofalo's Suspiria as like a thigh piece. I want it so badly, and it's going to happen one of these days. My number two is Phenomena. My number three is Deep Red. Number four is Opera. And number five is Tenebrae.
Ooh.
Yeah, yes. Throwing in something a little different there.
Brad.
All right. Yeah, I don't be disappointed.
deep cut Brad Henderson over here. Deep cut Henderson.
No, I don't have any deep cuts. No, I don't think Argento has deep cuts.
I don't other think than, he does, no.
It's the stuff that he writes that he hasn't directed. But I mean, to me, I mean, maybe Inferno might be his lesser known movie. I don't know.
I think it's usually if it's his like big ones tend to be his 1 to 2 word titles. Mm-hmm. And then when you start getting into the longer titles, that's when I'm like, oh, yeah. Okay, you're a cool guy.
I think there's more of a resurgence like over the past like 5 years with Bird and Flies that have made it a little more popular than some of his even later stuff. But anyways, no deep cuts. Mine is Four Flies on Grey Velvet, Deep Red, Tenebrae, Sleepless. I guess that's the deep cut. It's like from 2001. Cat O' Nine Tails is my other one. So no Suspiria or Phenomena.
Ow.
Wow.
Yeah. I prefer the Black Glove Killers more than the Supernatural.
That's fair. That's a fair assessment.
No, I totally get that from you, man.
My deepest cut would be an honorable mention of something he wrote in the 60s called Today We Kill, Tomorrow We Die. I would check it out. It's a lot of fun. It's about a guy who was sent to jail, prison, for a crime that he didn't commit. So when he gets out, he hires a gang of baddies to go after the people that wronged him, which is a lot of fun. But anyways, Argento has some great westerns he wrote from back in the day. I mean, even from Once Upon a Time in the West was... He did the story and some of the dialogue on that, but he's fun with the westerns back in the '60s.
Very cool. My list is yes, all those. No, I mean it would be Bird with the Crystal. I mean, you know, like I say, very standard. But Bird with the Crystal Plumage, Suspiria, Phenomena, Tenebrae, and like I think that's all I've seen. I think Deep Red. So you have to
have a top five because you've seen five.
I've seen five. It's ridiculous.
I love every Argento movie I've ever seen.
I really want to see Opera.
But yeah. That's the thing, man. If you're five for five, I know that you'll like his, you know, his other stuff too. If you enjoy everything like that, I mean, Argento is very good at homaging his own work as well.
Yeah.
And he does it in a beautiful sense, too. It's not a copy of a copy of a copy. I mean, he knows what he wants to see. He likes imagery. He loves colors. He likes to experiment, you know. Yeah. And, you know, one thing I have always appreciated a lot about Argento was, you know, the big debate between people is Suspiria a giallo film? In a sense, yes, it is. In a sense, it's no, it's not. But I believe it's solely off of Argento trying to recreate the genre that was dying and is dead We're lucky if we get a giallo a year now. But, you know, I liked what he was trying to do for cinema in cinema. He inspired countless people. It's inspired me a great deal. Deep Red changed my life. You know, I appreciate what he was trying to do and what he has done. I don't think a lot of filmmakers have accomplished and be able to spread something like that. The only other person I can think of would be like John Carpenter, you know, and, you know, did the countless, basically inspired everybody to do a slasher film. You know, and the same thing as Argento, was doing giallo, like Black Glove Killers, plus he was doing kind of a supernatural thing. And he also just, he learned how to mesh things together. And I think a lot, we were talking about the music and phenomena, and, every time I say phenomena, I think of the Muppets and I want to hear somebody go, doo, doo, doo. Phenomena. You know, with those films and trying to incorporate how fun they are. I mean, look at the soundtracks. Like Phenomena, doesn't make any sense why those songs are in there sometimes. It actually is a little jarring when they come on because it's not what you expect. The same thing is like the soundtrack of Demons is fucking great. You know, you have, you know, Accept on that soundtrack. And, you know, it's just balls to the wall like fucking crazy.
Oh, yeah.
So I don't know, he knows how to blend so much into his movies to please such a wide variety of people. I think that's mainly why he was so popular, because he just hit all the notes. So and not too many filmmakers are able to do that, even if the music is a little jarring. But, you know, he used Simonetti to, you know, construct all these scores. You know, with Goblin, who, again, like just nails it almost each and every time.
He reuses some music in Phenomena from Goblin or Simonetti, doesn't he? There were certain cues, you know, themes that I heard that I thought I must have heard in Tenebrae. Well, maybe, I don't know.
It depends. I mean, when Simonetti kind of does his own thing and uses the Goblin name.
Yeah.
Yeah, some stuff is reused, but it's not like it's almost like kind of casually lifted, I guess I would say.
They do that a lot, those Italian composers, especially with, I've noticed it with, I think all like Fulci, Bava, and, you know, and Argento, like they'll bring in older scores, you know, to their other films. They'll just reuse them in certain scenes. And it, to me, it's no big deal. It's just, it's, I always tend to notice it when it
happens. I mean, usually it's the Italians ripping off the Americans, to be honest with you, when it boils down to it. But,
well, no, I can always tell if it's like, you know, Goblin or Simonetti. Like it's, I'm like, I think that happened with, the Beyond reuses music in other film, or I just noticed that. And it's cool. Like I can dig it. But I think Phenomena has some of that. I think they borrow from, that they take some musical cues from Tenebrae, but then I think maybe Tenebrae maybe took some stuff from Suspiria, you know. So who knows? It all kind of flows together.
Okay.
Anyway, that's just something I noticed. I don't know.
Yeah.
Whatever. Whatever.
All right. Sorry, Sean.
Well, I think that's going to do it for this episode. I want to get to our sponsors in a second, but first, Alejandra Gonzalez and Stephanie Crawford, thank you for joining us. If you both can let us know where people can find you on the internet, where you're writing, where you're podcasting, and all that stuff, that'd be great.
So I write for F This Movie, and you can find me again at sick_66. I finally was able to say it right. Or you can just look up The Blair Bitch and you'll find me there too.
Nice.
Yeah, you can just check me out on Twitter at Scrawfish. Anything I ever do, I will be really annoying about on there. So one stop.
Very nice. And you can find us over at thescreamcast.com. There is a link to our Twitter there, scream_cast. And in that link, there's links to BJ, Brad, and myself. You can find us there. Speaking of thescreamcast.com, you can check out our sponsors,
over there. Vinegar Syndrome, of course, I'm going to give them huge thank yous for sending us stuff to talk about each month. And then Wolfman of Mars for providing the music for the show, and Kevin Spencer for providing our logo. Grindhousevideo.com. Please check them out. And they are giving us they're giving us giveaways each month. If you're a $5 and up patron, you'll be entered into a drawing at the end of the month. But he's very competitive with his prices. And if I would say, if you're looking for a film, especially Arrow, a decent price on Arrow stuff, he is always very fair and competitive with Arrow releases in particular. So grindhousevideo.com. And then Coffee Shop of Horrors, use the code SCREAMCAST at coffeeshopofhorrors.com. You get 10% off of your order if you're a coffee fanatic like myself. And of course, Patreon.
Say it right, Sean, so people know where to go.
Patreon.com/scream_cast. We have a few levels there. $1 level is basically a little tip for us. You like what we do, you want to support the show. $3 and up is you get early access to each episode, usually a day or 2 days before it goes over to oneofus.net. You'll get access to our bonus podcasts, which we promise more are coming to the Screamcast late night. And then, the access to another bonus episode that, BJ will be putting out. And BJ, I'm going to ask you to let us know about that in just a second.
Sure.
And then the $5 or more, you get to basically drive the conversation of the bonus podcast, Screamcast Late Night. You'll also get entered into the drawing each month for some free shit from grindhousevideo.com. And, the more patrons we get, we hit certain goals, we're going to be changing these around, adding more things. And, we do want to do a Google Hangout, live Google Hangout, again. So $5 and up patrons, you'll all be invited to hang out with us and chat movies for that. So, also there are, official sponsorship spots available if you are a company and need a sponsor. BJ, let us know about your bonus podcast. You threw this idea my way and I was like, fuck yeah, let's do it.
Yeah. So as, most of you know, we cover a wide variety of genre films on this podcast, and because of our relationship and our love for the films that Vinegar Syndrome has restored and distributed, that does mean that we talk about pornography. And by we, me and Brad, because Sean won't watch it. So the back room has been something that a lot of you seem to really enjoy. But I do also understand that not everybody is super into vintage pornography, and they kind of check out because it's just really not their style. It's not their taste. Because of the internet, we're all, you know, sick and depraved more than we ever have been. So I'm going to be starting a bonus podcast where I will be recommending a modern example of one of the Vinegar Syndrome releases that we have been talking about. Just to give you kind of an idea of like where we're headed. We all know that my favorite Vinegar Syndrome pornography release is Hot and Saucy Pizza Girls, but mine a lot too. Of people, it's just so good. So I was giving the modern kind of version of that same sort of thing. And my recommendation with that is Samantha Mack Pizza Girl, released by Burning Angel. So you'll get to hear me talk about the two of those different pornographies, why I think that they're, you know, compatible. Obviously they're both about pizza girls, and what you can expect from both of them and where to find them legally to pay for it. Because I'm not about to give you red tube links or anything like that, but that's basically what I'll cover. So if there are Vinegar Syndrome titles that you really like, but you're looking for something a little bit more modern, or you're looking for something that, you know, has sort of that same feel, but is, you know, for the new millennium, let me know, and we'll see what we can do.
Awesome. So look for that very soon. All right, well, that's going to do it for this week's show. Thank all of you for listening, and I would say, I mean, like, hit us up online. I love it when people are listening to the show and interacting with us on Twitter. It makes it a lot of fun. Makes my work day go by fast. So scream_cast as you're listening would be fantastic. And hit everyone else up on Twitter as well. Follow everybody. And, we'll talk to all of you guys next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Oh, don't tell me you're leaving. The party's just begun.